Hi. The Guardian's Polly Toynbee. Now, Toynbee, of course, as I've probably said before, is a big name in the sort of Labour, Fabian Society, broad left. I think I'm right in saying the family are in with the Brexit, they're in the School of Economics. So Toynbee's in the Guardian today, looking forward to the Labour conference. I say looking forward, considering the possibility, considering the looming possibility of a Labour disaster or Starmer escaping unscathed from the Labour conference might be a better way of putting it. I don't know if she's actually looking forward in the sense that we all look forward to Christmas or Eid or whatever. So she's looking forward to the Labour conference, and she's written an article on the idea that Labour can be successful and can defeat the Conservatives if they manage to convince the voter that they're a plausible emergency service, given that what she thinks is the disaster that the Conservatives preside over and to a large extent have created. So the kind of running theme of our article is that the modern Labour Party needs to do what the Blairites did, which is to represent a plausible alternative in the face of a disaster. Tony Blair famously succeeded in 94, 97, elected in 97 with a crushing majority, 418 Labour MPs, even more, much more successful than Johnson was in 2019. But Blair was successful because Labour had message discipline and looked like they might provide an alternative to the John Major government. So the hopes are pinned on Starmer, the ex-lawyer head of the Director of Public Prosecutions. I think I think the head of the DPP. He was the Director of Public Prosecutions, I think. So he's something of an unknown. A lot of Labour voters, when challenged with a picture, can't pick him out. They don't know who he is. And the policy suggestions that have been made by Labour since Corbyn disappeared haven't had any purchase, really. The Labour manifesto in 2019 did a lot of damage in terms of being a kind of Argos catalogue of all things to all men, and people didn't believe it. He also lacks what a lot of people think is the kind of glamour of Johnson. I was a Conservative Party candidate in 2019, or rather, I applied to be a candidate for a seat in Ayr. And one of the members asked me at the questions and answers, how do we import some of the Boris Johnson glamour into Scotland? I said, I don't know if you've any experience of how Boris Johnson plays in Scotland, but I would strongly suggest we do everything possible to keep him and everything he represents well away from the Scottish electorate. But less so in England. Johnson's thought to be a bit of a card, a bit of a character. Some of it might be contrived. It may be the case that he ruffles his hair strategically. He probably does sit on his jacket in cars to make it look appropriately crushed. But nevertheless, whatever he's got, Starmer lacks. The veer of the man, the suggestion that he might be a mate, is one that radiates from Johnson and not from Starmer. Johnson walked right past me at the Perth hustings, actually, funnily enough. And the thing that struck me most about him was, one, he looks a lot older in the flesh than he might do on TV, and two, he's a lot shorter than you'd think. I don't know what position he could play in a rugby pitch, but I suspect prop would be his preferred position. He's like a washing machine. But anyway, so the Labour Party right now is languishing and should be doing much better because this is the mid-term lull. Governments are elected, they experience a lull, and then they often pick up as the election period begins. So we're now a couple of years on from the general election, and Labour should be doing better. The calamity of 2019, which I think the scale of it was a surprise to a lot of people. The suggestion is that it was a lot longer in the making than people realise. Toynbee quotes Ben Page, who's quoting Hemingway. He doesn't acknowledge it's Hemingway, but Hemingway in, I think, The Sun Also Rises, I think. But there's a that one of the characters says he went bankrupt slowly at first and then quickly. And Labour in 2019 had been going bankrupt slowly at first and then quickly. It's an arch remark. I don't know if it's true. The interesting thing about the 2019 defeat, and indeed the other defeats that Labour suffered 2010 onwards, is that what they really reveal is the lunacy of the British single member simple plurality system, first past the post. Because what it does is it creates a ridiculous volatility based on events and cohorts' reactions to those events and policy initiatives. Labour in 2019 did much, much better than people remember in terms of total share of the vote, but they were losing votes in places where the marginal seats were that they needed to win. So the idea that Labour has been going backwards during the entire period. As a Tory, I look at the choice of Jeremy Corbyn, and I can scarcely believe that anyone would be so unwise. But that's because they haven't seen, or they didn't see Labour in the 70s and 80s, and there's no real understanding of a character like Michael Foot and the degree to which such a character is completely toxic with the working class. So I don't know whether Ben Page's remark that the Labour went bankrupt quickly in 2019, having been going slowly bankrupt for a longer period, but certainly it was a bad result, particularly in terms of number of seats rather than vote share. They had a problem, of course, which was that they've got a problem right now, rather. They had a problem in 2019 with Brexit and being terribly divided over how to respond to Brexit. The Tory party was divided as well, but of course Johnson united them behind Get Brexit Done because they were all terrified of the prospect of the right of the Tory party again becoming a problem in the way that UKIP and then I think the Brexit party, they renamed themselves. The Tory right is terrified, particularly because the constituency associations tend to be much more Eurosceptic than the average voter, and it's the constituency associations that deselect you and kick you out, or pick somebody else, or don't work for you and stop giving money. So the parties were divided up to 2019, but the Tory party's got a tremendous capacity for rallying behind anybody that can keep them in their jobs. Labour's more prepared to lose, and so that was a problem. And then since they've had the massive problem of COVID, it's very difficult to attack a government that is managing a crisis because it's perceived as being disloyal. Now, the Tories have been doing a lot of polling recently, a huge amount of money, Tory donors in particular, because they, of course, can pay for polling without having to give money to the party. And the polling can be structured so as to help the party without being directly paid for by the party. And they've been paying for that polling precisely because they want to know why it's working, as it were. How is it possible for the Tory party to win? How is it possible for Johnson to win a majority in 2019 when David Cameron faced with the terrible banking crisis, housing crisis, housing price collapse, and then the banking crisis, and the widely disliked Gordon Brown? How could they not win a proper majority in 2010? 306 seats in 2010. So the Tory donors are now polling regularly, trying to find out what the Johnson magic is in order to try and retain the parliamentary majority that he's got currently, which is allowing him to do lots and lots of things, both domestically and internationally, that wouldn't otherwise be possible. Faced with a rebellion over anything, whether it's something to do with the trade agreements that were striking around the world in a relationship with the EU, or a national insurance hike to pay for care homes, Johnson can get away with it because his majority is big enough to discourage real rebellions. Because a rebellion is futile unless there's a chance of success, because all you do is stigmatise yourself as being unreliable, and you shut off the possibility of ministerial posts. So that 80 majority is big enough to discourage rebellion, in the same way that Blair's massive 1997 majority completely nixed rebellion. Only the sort of Jeremy Corbyns of this world will take the trouble to vote against a measure if the government is 418 MPs, because it's completely pointless voting against them, and all you do is shut off your possibility of advancement and indeed help during elections. People underestimate this. One of the things that ministers do is they go to the constituencies of favoured MPs and lend them some glamour and go around the doors with them, and that helps to keep you in your seat. And you don't get that if you're a rebel. I was trying to help Paul Masterton retain his seat in East Renfrewshire, and Lord Ahmed, I think, was one day soaked to the skin with his blue jacket on, coming into the little hut that the Tories have got to get a packet of Monster Munch and a can of Fanta before going out again. And Masterton got that help because he was seen to be a good, loyal MP. In the end, it didn't help him. But if you're seen to be disloyal, you don't get that. The Labour Party is much better, as Toynbee says, at internal fighting, and they're still fighting internally. They're still disputing Labour over the future direction of the party, and that again helps the government. The government, though, faces headwinds. You've got these tax rises that have yet to kick in, but they will shock people. You've got significant consumer price inflation, particularly in the things that people notice, like foodstuffs, and of course shortages as well, and the price hikes that are going to be caused by problems in the supply chain and drivers, delivery drivers and so on, they'll all end up in the price at the end of the day. So the Conservative government will start to suffer from this. The IFS today, as Toynbee notes, has also reported on this supposed jobs bonanza. Most of these jobs that have been advertised are very low paid. The number of graduate jobs has fallen quite sharply. So what we've got is a jobs bonanza in low paid work. And that's not the sort of thing that's going to make people feel good when they're faced with rising prices, in particular for essentials. You can't really do much to trim your gas and electricity prices. So anyone on a variable tariff, and variable tariffs tend to be the kind of thing that folk who are less good at managing their affairs end up on. So it's often folk in chaotic, difficult circumstances that are firefighting all day, every day, who end up not managing their domestic gas and electricity supply, and they're the ones in the variable tariffs. Often as well, sometimes people end up in meters because they've not paid bills in the past, and that becomes very expensive. So low-paid work and an end to the furlough and the £20 a week cut in universal credit, or the ending of the extra payment, all of that is going to feed through, thinks Toynbee, into the Tories' numbers. So Labour is not that far behind in terms of national polling. You're talking about a few percent. And the care home crisis and reduced funding for schools and everything else, all the other headwinds the government faces, might well cause them more difficulties than commentators right now think. And also, the things that the government thinks it can do to shore up the so-called red, now blue, wall. One of the reasons why the government's panicking is because the MPs who've been elected from this part of the country, across the top part of the sort of Yorkshire Humberside, etc., down into the Midlands. That part of the country is full of people who are extremely angry about the migration crisis and the inability of the government to stop these daily arrivals on the south coast. And if you add in tax rises and reduced services and higher prices for basics, which come to much bigger percentages of ordinary folks' budget than they do for richer folk. You know, if a food price rise when you spend more of your income on food is a big issue. So all of that is going to be a problem. And then these infrastructure projects that are supposed to boost the economy and provide skilled jobs, that'll take years at least and probably decades to come through. So if that's really all that Michael Gove has to offer in terms of this levelling up agenda, that's going to be very difficult as well. So Toynbee thinks that the Tory party might do what others have done in the past, which is to lose an election and gift it to the opposition as long as the opposition seem competent. That's the basic story of British elections. The ERM, the exchange rate mechanism, the British tried to pretend that a pound was worth 2 Deutsche Marks 95, and it wasn't. It was worth 2.45, and that eventually blew up in our faces, cost us 5 billion quid, cost the Tory party its reputation for economic competence, and gifted the 1997 election to Labour, despite the fact that the economy had recovered. We actually, ironically, went through an export-led boom, precisely because our currency fell to an appropriate level, and it became much easier for us to export things to Germany, because all of a sudden, what cost 29,500 Deutsche Marks only cost 24,500, and therefore people might buy your car when they wouldn't have done before. So the 1997 election was a really good example of why a government that loses its essential selling point, the unique selling point in the case of the Tory party, which is economic competence, you can get hammered as they did. Same thing happened, of course, to a lesser extent to Gordon Brown. The first time we had a banking run, a run on a bank, people actually turning up and demanding their money from Northern Rock because they were terrified the bank was going to go under. That kind of thing really damages the reputation of a chancellor turned prime minister who talks about prudence and responsibility and tries to convey the classic lounge suit proper politician. Gordon Brown's act as being the friendly bank manager, the person who lacked Blair's glamour but nevertheless was cleverer and better able to manage, that all got blown clean out the water with the banking crisis following the housing collapse in America first and then the UK, and that's why they lost the 2010 election. So if you're a plausible opposition and the government shoots itself in the foot, reloads and shoots again, you can win the election. And as I say, the sensitivity of governments to that perception of fundamental incompetence and an inability to maintain a reputation for probity and being in charge. You know, the SNP in Scotland has been very keen to place Nicola Sturgeon front and centre on a lectern at every single stage through the COVID crisis. And it's because she conveys, and there's no point in understating it, it's true, she conveys a sense of seriousness and capability that most of our government doesn't, and the stats don't support. The Scottish results have been bad, but Sturgeon's performances have been good, and that matters. So if you lose that perception, you're in big trouble. Toynbee suggests a COVID surge could be enough. You know, a good lockdown at some point in the autumn or winter could be enough. People have sacrificed a lot. They've had these jags. They've taken on huge loans to try and keep their businesses afloat. They've survived on 80% of their money, which in some cases has been plenty, particularly because if you've got high travel to work costs. But for other folk, it's been very difficult because if you're on low wages, again, a percentage of your low wage is not wonderful. But of course, these disasters only help if there's a competent opposition. In 1983, Michael Foot and the Labour Party did not constitute a possible government, and consequently Thatcher, partly because of the Falklands War as well, but also because people looked at Michael Foot and he was very frail, very old, and a clever man by anyone's assessment. One of the, as I've said before, I think that one of the scallywags during the Second World War who were excused military service for terrible eyesight, but he was tasked to go and murder a pro-Nazi lord if the Germans invaded. So Michael Foot was given knives, guns and poisons so that he could walk from the House of Commons to the House of Lords and murder this particular pro-Labour peer. So he's actually trained to be an assassin, which is, it's a hell of a thought when you look at him in 1983. But Thatcher survived in 1983 because Michael Foot's alternative government was no alternative in anyone's perception. Same thing with Corbyn. And Corbyn, again, provides the kind of legacy that Labour doesn't need, because people remember the Corbyn extremism that followed on from him getting elected and then re-elected. The mistake some of the Labour MPs made was they thought that having included Corbyn in the ballot simply to provide the left with a choice, and that was an unwise thing to do. They then decided to challenge him and only encourage all the momentum kids to turn out again and vote for him. So Corbyn, in league with John McDonnell and a few others, Seamus Milne, felt that they could take the Labour Party back to 1983. And that perception persists despite the fact that he's long gone and Keir Starmer is as far from Jeremy Corbyn as anybody can imagine. And from a Tory point of view, all of that is slightly worrying given that the lead is narrowing. The Labour Party should be further ahead in the midpoint, but given all the other things that they've faced, COVID and the legacy of Corbyn and the fact that it's hard to structure parliamentary opposition when you're so far behind, 80 seats behind, everything you say can be pretty much ignored by the government because they've got the big battalions, they've got the numbers. It's much harder if you're Theresa May or David Cameron holding a coalition together. But Boris Johnson's a very, very secure position with the numbers he's got in the House of Commons. And even despite that, as I say, the lead is narrowing, as Toynbee notes. Starmer isn't hated. Labour can now get heard in a way that they couldn't in 2018, 2019 in working class communities. And if you maintain the right broad tone and perception for long enough, it begins to get through to the voter. They begin to know who you are, and you sound like a serious politician who might be electable, could provide an alternative. Because in British two-party politics, which has been fragile recently with the DUP and, of course, before that with Liberal Democrats, British two-party politics is still a reality. It's still the case that if you're against the Conservative Party, you're probably going to have to be for Labour. And the Tory party perception, the perception of the Tory party in the economy could come under a lot of pressure. And the other great card that they always play is law and order. And again, that's already under massive pressure. Having boats arriving in the Channel ports and having them brought in by the RNLI and the Royal Navy today, I notice, that does not contribute to the perception that Priti Patel has got a handle, nor people sitting in the M25 blocking the traffic, nor people running about the streets with baseball bats and knives, nor a three-year backlog for criminal trials. You can't hold everybody in remand. The prisons are full. So you get to the point where basically even people with serious offences cannot be remanded for the amount of time you need. And you end up with the injustice as well of people pleading guilty to offences that they deny because they've been held in remand for so long that the time taken into consideration if they pled guilty would be less than the time they spent in remand. Criminal barristers are complaining that they've got clients that they think are innocent, but the client who spent a year in remand says, if I plead guilty, I'll get 18 months with time off in lieu, and I'll be out of here today, so I'll plead guilty. So people who maintain their innocence are pleading guilty. And again, all of this contributes to the perception that the Tory party isn't really the party of law and order, it's the party of injustice and disorder. And if Labour can play on that, then that'll begin to cut through, particularly with the kind of communities that Labour targeted in 1994-97, with tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. And Starmer's background should help them do that. Labour's broadly trusted in the public services. Toynbee floats the possibility that they could try something radical on either the EU, for example, suggesting that you join the customs union, and therefore that eliminates an awful lot of the problems you've got with trade, especially in Northern Ireland, albeit at the price of making the trade agreements that you're negotiating with people like Australia much more difficult or impossible. So Labour might try something in the EU, or she suggests proportional representation. That would be really, really significant, because the fact of the matter is that if you take classical conservatism and the Liberal Democrat, Labour, SNP broad position on the left-right agenda, the country is to the left of the classical conservative position. Johnson has sprawled across both the right and the centre, because he's managed to avoid hard choices, because bond yields are down at 0.3%. Any kind of recovery in interest rates and bond yields will make what he's been doing impossible. You can't borrow $400 billion a year forever. So the country is to the left of where a classical Conservative government is. And Boris Johnson has managed to avoid being placed where a classical Conservative government should be, only because we've got extraordinary circumstances and a tolerance for borrowing among Tory backbenchers and Tory businessmen and Tory donors and voters that wouldn't be there normally. So so the Labour Party can win, thinks Toynbee, if they place themselves as the alternative to the Tories and seem as if they might be. What they have to do is woo the sort of the softer part of the Tory vote, the part of the Tory vote that is able to be taken over. There's a famous saying in politics, which is, you've no eternal friends, you've no, or international relations, you've no eternal friends, no eternal enemies, only eternal interests. The same holds true when it comes to voters. The person who will definitely vote for you doesn't matter. The person who definitely, any hardcore voter doesn't matter. The only people that matter are the ones that could be persuaded. And it's possible that there's a significant group of voters who are now in a position where they're prepared to listen to what Starmer has to say. And if the Johnson government comes up against any significant problems, as the winter is likely to throw up, we're likely to see a care home hospital crisis. We're likely to see a flu epidemic to add to the tail end of the COVID pandemic, or hopefully the tail end of the COVID pandemic. We're likely to see some kind of reaction to higher energy prices, gas shortages, higher food prices, and continued downward pressure on incomes, particularly because the national insurance hike will kick in the new year. So all of that should give Labour a chance. Now, I think Toynbee is right in much that she says, and it's depressing that she's right, because her way of framing the issue, which is to say that Labour needs to be the plausible emergency service that will swoop in if there seems to be a problem, that's true, and it's based on a 170-year at least tradition. And of course, you can argue, you know, the Athenian democracy was the same 2,500 years ago. But it's based on this idea that government's incredibly potent and government can do great things. And therefore, the disaster that's produced by the people that you elected based on exactly that set of expectations and exactly that prospectus can be fixed by the next person. As if you were having constantly bad surgery and re-employing more quack doctors to do further things without ever realising that it's your addiction to quack surgery that's causing the problem. Famously, Hume and others had a very limited view of what government could do. Hume talks about magistracy, and by magistracy he means government. He means, having authorities that will protect people and their lives and property. And of course, famous John Locke, the purpose of government is to secure people and their property, by which he means their life as well, the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is to secure these rights that governments are instituted among men. The part-time U.S. legislators, the original U.S. Congress after the Philadelphia Convention, I think the intention was to have annual elections for the House, if I remember correctly. And in lots of American states, there's no expectation that the legislature would be meeting all the time. In my view, there's a very good reason why Scotland's in the terrible state that it's in, and it's precisely because health, education, and law and order are not mainly policy and legislative problems. They're mainly administrative and managerial, and therefore what you need is somebody who's in charge in the same way that the chief executive and a councillor is in charge, making sure the machine runs. But it's not mainly about passing new laws and having new policy initiatives. And the reason why Scotland's in the terrible state it's in is precisely because we've ignored that. We've created the opposite of magistracy, and now we've got a whole load of people at the bottom of the Royal Mile who've got nothing better to do all day than to try and think of something that will justify their existence by changing a policy or changing a law. And so the reason why it matters that the Labour Party is seen to be a plausible fire service is because people think in terms of these sort of metaphors. They've got this tendency to assume that government is terribly potent. They elect a government, it proves itself not to be potent, things go wrong, things are supposed to make things better, make them worse, and therefore you elect somebody else. It's the story of modern British politics from the so-called strange death of liberal England. The great book, is it Dangerfield, I think, from memory? The strange death of liberal England. How the broad liberal assumptions of 19th and early 20th century England were replaced by the activist trade union inspired theories of the Labour Party. People stopped voting for government as a limited activity and responsibility on the individual, and voted for government as an extensive activity that can make the individual's life better. And John Stuart Mill, of course, predicted this right back in the middle of the 19th century. With the expansion of the franchise, you will have this pitch made to the voter that government can be usefully big, and that the people can collectively form what amounts to an insurance society and all make claims and none pay for policies. Because that essentially is what the left's pitch is. Now, of course, they rarely articulate it in those terms, but each individual listening to the pitch, which is articulated as a kind of national insurance where we're all in this together, the people who make the argument know that they can't say you'll be able to claim and you'll be better off than the average, despite the fact that reason tells you that there has to be some average payment in, which is greater than the average payment out. The cost of government is something, and therefore, whatever we all chip in, we're each going to get out less than we chipped in the same way that an insurance company that pays when your car gets smashed up has to pay out on average less than people pay in. The average policyholder paying £500 has to get less than £500 worth of repairs out of it, because the company itself costs something to run. So it stands to reason that when you start trying to have a social welfare safety net or an NHS or anything else, it stands to reason that the average person has to be getting out less than they put in, because the machine costs something. And of course, the left's pitch is, well, firstly, you'll be paying in much, much less because of the part of the income distribution you fit into. And maybe you won't have to pay anything at all in, and you'll get something out. So this idea that government can enrich the generality is built into the bricks now. And the reason why people get so disappointed once they've elected a government is because it doesn't transform their lives. The initial enthusiasm and excitement for things like pensions. My grandmother was, always very keen to make sure she paid her full stamp, so she got her full 44 years in the scheme, so she got a full pension. The first pensions and the first years of the NHS were a revolution in people's lives. They couldn't believe they were actually getting these services free. And with each passing year, folk become more and more disenchanted with the services they've currently got. And more animated by promises of a better future. So that you start off in 1948 with an NHS, and you end up in 2021 with promises of a universal basic income. Now, let's pay you not to work. So we've got ourselves in a position now where disappointment with government is inevitable, precisely because the hopes of what government can achieve are so ridiculously unrealistic. And there doesn't seem to be a way out of it, because for 140, 150 years, we did manage to expand government and do more and more, thanks to probably a one-off secular rise in the economic returns from work. We went, people forget, Jordan Peterson was talking about this. People forget, and Hayek said the same thing. Hayek said for the first time, at the end of the 19th century, for the first time in the history of the world, it had become possible to work for 2 days and eat for a week. And Peterson said the same thing. We forget that basically for most of human history, people were just fighting for calories, and getting enough to eat was the fundamental requirement. So we've went through this period in the last sort of century and a half of explosive economic growth. And it may well have been, if not a one-off, something approaching a one-off. And because the expansion of democracy has taken place at the same period of time, the same century and a half, we've become convinced that we can help ourselves to more and more from something called the government. And the reason why governments lose elections is because we're getting to the end stage where no government can give us what we now demand. Enthused as we are by the idea of money for nothing, there's nothing now that can be promised us that would be adequate. Somebody said that, one of the union negotiators for General Motors said that about the collapse of Detroit. He said, we're getting guys in, I think it was probably be 2012. He says, well, we're paying guys in 2012 $60 an hour for unskilled work, and every year we get an offer from the management which we have to try and sell to the workers as being better than last year's offer. They're in a situation where they can be put on furlough for a year or more, and they get paid money to stay at home and then get brought back in when the factory begins to pick up. And it becomes a thing where people lobby the union and lobby the management to try and be one of the furloughed workers so they can have a year off their work. So $60 an hour for not working, never mind $60 an hour for working in an unskilled job with incredible pension and health benefits. And this union organiser who knew the numbers, who knew the reality, and talked to the management and knew that some of them were okay guys, you know, he actually knew what was going to happen. He said, every year we have to try and sell this deal to the guys, and they just don't understand. And of course, what he predicted happened. Detroit went bust. So there is no good reason why governments suffer midterm slumps, but there's a very bad reason, and that is that people continually vote to make themselves wealthy, and no government can make you wealthy. The SNP, ironically, got hit in the midterm in 2017, and the midterm in inverted commas in 2017. They were elected in 2016 to the Scottish Parliament, and I think, what did they get? Low 60s, nearly a majority from memory. They swept the board in the 2015 general election, and then in what amounted to a midterm general election, Theresa May's snap election, they lost a whole lot of seats. And that was because the public had voted twice to be rich, and it hadn't arrived. Now they were disappointed. So, as I say, the volatility that Toynbee identifies is real, but a lot of it is just based on very, very silly ideas of what government can do. And if you wanted to be sarcastic about it, you would suggest that again, John Stuart Mill was right. There are people who have inherited nothing from their ancestors except the expectation that they should be able to get something for nothing. In other words, if your grandfather didn't leave you any money, that was because he spent it all. And it might be that the reason why he spent it all was because he was full of himself and enjoyed his own life and didn't really care too much about yours. And if you've inherited his attitudes, then you're probably going to be the kind of person that's going to spend every single penny and not leave anything for your grandkids. So the one thing you inherited from your grandparent is the selfishness or extreme rational self-interest, which both means that you inherited nothing and inspires you to demand it from other folk through the mechanism of government. And arguably, as I say, that's where we are. As to the emphasis that Toynbee places on unions, and indeed Starmer on unions, Starmer gets pictured in The Guardian standing under a sign from the TUC conference about unions being all about dignity at work. As I've said many times before, if you think about a union, now you can argue that in the public sector, where people who've never had to run a business get themselves into management positions, for example, in a college, you can argue in the public sector, unions are a check on unaccountable, hopeless management. Shareholders will keep a grip of a company if it's run badly by managers because they don't want to lose their investment. But in the public sector, you can argue that maybe unions do have a different kind of function. The Police Federation stops the worst kinds of stupidity among superintendents and deputy chief constables, precisely because left to their own devices, without any rival to compete with, there's no private sector rival, effectively, a few security companies, but there's no real rival to the police. And therefore, given that the senior cops have never run a business, and given that they've got no competition, it can easily go wrong. So you can argue that public sector unions have got a role, but in the private sector and generally across the board, unions are devices to restrict supply and raise price. And again, this is something that Mill saw, and it's something that every economist that looks at it sees. The point of a union is to prevent competition from other workers so that the price can be lifted above the free market price and you can rip off consumers. People who've genuinely got something to offer, like, for example, getting your gas boiler fitted. There is no union that regulates the price of getting a gas boiler fitted, but you won't be able to get it done for less than about 350, 400 quid, maybe a bit more than that. And that's because it's quite skillful doing it, and you probably get called out for little problems in the weeks afterwards. So by the time you've paid for all your costs and actually trained to become a gas boiler fitter and become skilled at it, you can probably demand that free market price of £50 an hour or something like that to fix it. Which is exactly why Box T and all the other companies charge you 1500 quid for a new boiler. It's impossible to undercut them because it's impossible to do a good job for less because that's what the boilers cost and that's what it costs to fit them. There's no cartel, there's no union organising prices. The reason why you need to restrict supply when it comes to selling ice cream in deprived housing estates is because if you allowed the free market to operate, you wouldn't be able to make any money doing it. You have to stop other people by smashing up their vans and threatening with shotguns. And that's what a union does. It restricts supply and thereby raises price. And people like Starmer, who are more than smart enough to understand why a union is a labour cartel, have to pretend otherwise. And we, the people, have chosen to pretend otherwise for 150, 170 years. We forget that we're no longer in a position where one employer locally can dictate terms to the entire local workforce, or a handful of employers in a region can dictate terms. Those days are long gone, but we choose to pretend otherwise because thinking through the implications upsets us. Thinking through the idea, thinking through to the conclusion, which is you have to be a highly skilled worker because the world is globally competitive. And what's going to happen is you're going to get paid your marginal product. You're going to get paid what you're worth in terms of your output. And you'd better make sure, therefore, that the machine you're using is not the main thing that's contributing to your output. You'd better make sure that you're the ophthalmologist who, despite the fact the machine costs £500,000, the laser eye surgery machine, they still need your skill in order to make it work. There was a thing in America. There was laser eye correction in America. Some people suggested that if you took away the sort of surgical element, the reason why you had to have LASIK, LASIK, rather than PRK, photorefractive keratectomy. The lasers basically will correct your vision if you just set it up and let it run and use the machine to take away the surface of your eye, which will grow back in about a couple of days. Now, that was called no-touch PRK. And the reason why the ophthalmologists, the eye doctors, the qualified medics were so against no-touch PRK, which could be done in the high street by anybody, was precisely because it would have ended their job. The argument was that they love a dangerous interventionist procedure like LASIK precisely because it prevents competition from others who would undercut them. And that's a classic example of complete selfishness without any thought whatsoever to the public good. And as I say, it's not the sole prerogative of the working class. I mean, if you look at solicitors in England, they defended their monopoly of conveyancing until Margaret Thatcher just broke it by introducing licensed conveyancers, because conveyancing was just easy money for solicitors, no skill involved, or far less skill than needed by a solicitor, and therefore they fought to keep their work. So as I say, we've got all kinds of assumptions about what government can do, and we've got all kinds of assumptions about what trade unions are for. And the labour movement, the broad labour movement, is committed to avoiding the truth about what the reality of the world is. Government isn't transformative in the way that Labour needs it to be. Trade unions aren't able to push water uphill without some other problem. You can lift, for example, when I was a boy, we still had arguments in favour of import controls. Let's not have Japanese cars coming into the country because it's putting people out of work in British Leyland and Ford. And I remember being at school, and that was you could end up having violence if you suggested otherwise. If you suggested that secretaries who've actually got real jobs shouldn't be made to pay for a higher price for an Austin car, a British Leyland car, than a cheaper Japanese car that actually worked and started in the morning, people became very angry and could easily become violent. So, as I say, from my right wing, centre right Tory point of view, the Labour movement is built now on obvious falsehoods, and the fact that it's built on falsehoods doesn't mean it has to stop, because most people are not really interested. Most people are not listening to this podcast. Most people are not prepared to think through exactly how a trade union could possibly raise wages and how it operates, how it can possibly frustrate market mechanisms so as to advantage the present providers. The only way it can do that, if you think about it, is to do what OPEC does, which is to increase the price of oil by reducing the supply of oil. And that means that ordinary folk pay more for oil than they should do. It's not difficult, as I say, to think it through, but as somebody once said, it's extremely difficult to convince a man of anything if his income depends on him not understanding it. The same is also true when it comes to sort of endemic stupidity, when it comes to this business about not being able to challenge a government during a pandemic. That again is based on things that are true, but if you examined them, you would be dismayed. So the classic thing people always say in a war is that if you simply abandon a bad decision, lives will have been lost in vain. That's one of the reasons why politicians continue with stupid wars, because lives will have been lost in vain. What a stupid thing to say. Because how does it possibly help to have more lives lost in vain if you already have lost some lives in vain? It makes no sense whatsoever. The same thing is true when it comes to COVID and disloyalty. The idea that you are disloyal to the government if you stand up and say, infection will confer broad immunity, vaccines will probably confer narrow immunity, viruses mutate. We've got good, sound medical reasons for thinking that if we protect the most vulnerable and allow others to become infected, we could get through this quickly with fewer deaths. And if you want to stigmatize me and call that herd immunity and killing people, you can do. But if you don't listen, you'll kill more in the long run. Now, it is not disloyalty to say that. It's not disloyal to say we have 20,000 care homes in the UK. If we can lock them down for 2 months for £1 million each, that's 20 billion. That is 20 billion versus 400 billion that we've spent already. We will probably, when it comes to less lost economic output, have lost twice that by the end of it, because we've now got kids who've been damaged for the rest of their life, and they'll probably be less productive and more demanding. They'll make more use of state services and be less productive and pay less tax for the rest of their life. So this ballpark figure, this could be an £800 billion crisis. We could arguably have got through it with less damage for 20 billion. Now, it is not disloyal to the state, and the state is not the same thing as the government. It is not disloyal to the state to be questioning whether it comes to a war or anything else. And the way you explain this reaction we have to critics during crises is social anthropology. It's got nothing to do with politics. It's social anthropology. This is near ape-like behavior. If a tribe is being threatened, it's not important to have the best decision. It's important to have a decision, because you need to be united. And the same thing with the military. You could go left flanking, you could go right flanking, you could go up the middle, but the most important thing is you get a quick decision made and there is clarity, which is exactly why you can't tolerate dissent in the middle of a battle. But the trouble is that modern politics isn't always like a battle, and often it isn't in any way like a battle at all. And what we do is we react to any questioning of a government if we're frightened, and we were frightened during COVID. So when people like Ioannidis at Stanford University, or Gupta at Oxford, or Woolhouse at Edinburgh, or anybody else, John Lee, the retired pathologist, that guy Mike Eden from the retired scientist Pfizer, I think, he was a scientific officer at Pfizer. Any of these people point out obvious things about how viruses mutate towards less lethal versions, and how we're actually creating hotbeds of more serious versions of the virus by having people in hospitals. Yeadon went through a really nice explanation as to exactly why a whole strategy was likely to result in a near endless pandemic. And of course, he more than anybody else has been proven to have a point. The Icelandic government is now saying, one of the chief medical officers was saying, they might be in on-off lockdowns for 15 years. They've been incredibly successful at preventing the spread of the virus because they're so isolated, and they're now looking at perhaps more than a decade of on-off lockdowns. That does not look particularly sensible. One of the reasons why, as I say, the Labour Party is in a difficult position, again, comes down not to politics, but something more primitive in terms of an explanation. Just as you can explain the hostility to challenges to the government in terms of social anthropology and the kind of groupish behaviour, you can explain the Labour Party in terms of psychology and complexes, like saviour complexes. Why is it the case that people in the Labour Party are so hostile to the idea that workers get paid their marginal product, that you can't actually get paid more than that except through coercion and making the lives of weaker people and poorer people worse? Why won't they analyse the trade union movement in terms of the economics of cartels? And the answer is, it's not enough for the working class to be liberated. It has to be the case that these people liberate the working class. It's not important that you're healthy. It's important that I be seen to help you because I'm your doctor. The Labour Party is full of people who venerate giants of the past, like Clement Attlee or Iron Bevan, and they have to themselves be part of that pantheon. They can't actually accept that the battle has been won, and that where once working people didn't have the opportunity to advance in society because they were deprived the elementary education that actually served the state's interest to provide them with, that investment in human capital made perfect sense. Those battles have been won. They're long gone. Everybody in this country is having $4,500 ballpark figure spent on their primary school education, a bit less actually in Scotland in most cases, but $4,500 in inner cities. So we're spending that kind of dough per kid on primary education. We're spending seven a year per kid on secondary education. So the idea that there's a battle to be won when it comes to, for example, universal health cover, who exactly is arguing against universal health cover? But the Labour Party can't actually accept that the battles that motivated the early Labour movement are over and that they've won the argument. They have to take yes for an answer, you know what I mean? And they can't, because if they took yes for an answer, what would be left for them? If you want to be the modern Clement Attlee, what can you do except find a new cause? If you want to be a Democratic Party activist in America, and see yourself as a giant like Lyndon Johnson, if Joe Biden wants to be Lyndon Johnson, what can he do but have enormous sympathy for Black Lives Matter and for environmental campaigners? Because he has to have something on which to hang his hat. He has to have a hook in order to join the pantheon. He can't be on Mount Rushmore or any modern version of Mount Rushmore unless he's got some great cause. And therefore, on the left, I think you have a messiah complex that you tend not to have on the right. The right is just full of people who want to hold on to their money. The left is full of people who want to hold on to a place in history. And that creates a very different mentality. The IFS report today on the fundamentals, on the job market and the kind of fundamentals that are driving it, the growth in low-skilled work, the shortages that are being created because of lower numbers of EU migrants and reduced participation in the workforce. You cannot say what I've said and others have said, which is you'll get paid roughly what you're worth. And unless you're a highly skilled worker, in a world of the free movement of goods, where there are choices between goods and services, people will not consume high-priced services, they'll buy goods instead. So even restaurant meals are competing with holidays abroad because both of them deliver human happiness or utility. So the fundamental truth of the economy is you'll get paid roughly what you're worth in terms of output and you have to be globally competitive. People can't accept that. They can't accept the universal credit hugely advantages low-skilled part-time work and it has caused huge distortions in the labour market. And far from not withdrawing the £20, we should withdraw the £20 and look to actually reverse out the universal credit system by requiring people to work more and more hours each passing year in order to receive universal credit. And if you work for the Daily Record and I ever stand for election, you can quote me on that because I don't care, right? It's true. We've created a situation where the transfer payments are distorting the labour market to a degree which is inconsistent with medium-term prosperity for the whole country. We need highly skilled workers paying lots of tax in order to have an NHS and have a social care system. And we will not achieve that if everybody's working 16 to 24 hours in any minimum wage job, which is what we're in danger of engineering. Most people want to have kids at some point. And if you take away all of the years that the kids are at school and encourage people to work between 16 and 24 hours in a low-paid, low-skilled job, you will end up with some fairly serious problems, both in terms of your current running deficit, the financing that is going to be necessary in order to pay for that 16 years where you're out of the proper labour market, but also as well in terms of the expectations that the kids acquire and also the capacities that you have if you ever do rejoin the labour market in late middle age. So this universal credit system is a complete disaster. Similarly, when it comes to the social care crisis that Toynbee thinks will advantage labour, it's really simple, social care. You've got a number of choices. You can bring in German-style Gastarbeiter guest workers from the Philippines and Thailand and the Gambia, and never, ever, ever, ever will they get British citizenship, but you pay them wages which are highly attractive compared to what they could earn at home, and that's a solution. That will solve the care home problem. And indeed, the folk in the care homes will be much better cared for on average than they are right now. You could hope for a medical windfall. You could hope that something will be done to stop, is it sarcopenia, I think they call it, muscle wastage as you get older. You can hope for some kind of steroid or near steroid that's going to stop muscle wastage so that people remain, even lazy people or people who, you know, become overweight, even they remain mobile when they get old, and they therefore avoid the kind of metabolic problems that they get through becoming physically inactive and bone wastage and muscle weakness, and therefore they'll die of sudden strokes and heart disease perhaps, or something that doesn't involve 5 years slowly wasting away in a care home. So you could hope for a medical miracle, if you like. You could move old folk abroad. You could start to have massive British care homes in Morocco, and folk would be warm all winter, and it would provide a huge amount of employment for the local Moroccans, and everybody would be a winner, and that would be much, much cheaper than having folk here. So if you don't want to move Thais and Filipinos to the UK on guest worker visas, move the old folk, if they're prepared to agree to it, to North Africa, and arrange EasyJet flights there. The family will spend more time with their old folks in retirement if they can go somewhere warm and the kids can go to the beach. And you can combine 2 weeks actually spending time with your parent and actually enjoy time together, as opposed to going in once a month, as I've seen, going to a care home regularly. The kids are never there, the grandkids are never there, it's short visits, and it's completely bloody miserable for everybody. So if you want to actually have retirement in North African coast, we can do that as well. And if you don't want to do any of those things, fine. It's unfixable. So, you know, there's an expression in the military, lead, follow, or get the hell out of the way. And in most of these issues, what we really need is people that are prepared to actually say, you know what, I don't mind being unpopular, I don't mind being radical, and I don't mind losing elections. I'm prepared to throw away everything that I get personally if we can actually sort this bloody problem out, or at least have some chance of sorting it out. And that mentality doesn't exist. It doesn't exist in the Labour Party, it doesn't exist in the Tory Party, it doesn't exist anywhere as far as I can see. As to infrastructure, the Labour Party is very big on infrastructure. The Tory Party under Boris Johnson is very big on infrastructure. There's a book by Alec Kerr, I think his name is, called Dogs and Demons. And he describes the absolute calamity of Japan over the last 30 years. And the ludicrous pouring of concrete that's taken place all over Japan to try and boost the economy in some kind of Keynesian attempt to avoid the inevitable, which was a readjustment of asset prices in 1989 and a load of people picking up their losses. If they'd just gone through that painful process in 1989, they'd have been through it by the early 1990s, but they chose not to. So the Japanese have engaged in a massive exercise in extended pretend in order to avoid admitting that the wonder economy they had in the 80s was built in sand or built in poured concrete. Now, all infrastructure projects are supposed to generate real returns. That's why a society gives up some of its present consumption to build the port, to build the airport, to build the road. If you can't justify it in terms of the fundamental economic returns, you shouldn't be doing it. And that's true regardless of whether it's HS2 or the Green New Deal. And it is utterly tedious to have to say something as obvious as this. The blithe disregard for economic fundamentals leads both parties into stupidities. The ERM, the exchange rate mechanism, selling Deutschmarks for less than you were buying them for was completely bloody stupid. The housing crisis, Gordon Brown is not daft. Gordon Brown must have known or should have known that if the price of substitute goods doesn't rise, substitute goods are goods that can be used in place of something else. Pasta, rice, potatoes are all substitute goods because they can stand in for each other. The price of substitute goods should rise together. Rents did not rise from 2003 to 2007. Prices went through the roof. That tells you it's an asset bubble. But Brown was prepared to take the boost to economic activity for all those joiners and plumbers and estate agents and so on. He was prepared to take the stamp duty that all the house sales resulted in. And the net result of that was Labour was destroyed because there was an economic tsunami. We could have been in a much stronger position if politicians had simply been, prepared to acknowledge what were obvious realities in the case of the housing crash, that it had to happen because if there was a genuine step change in demand, rents would have increased. A child would have known that this was a bubble. And indeed, that guy Paulson in America made $4 billion for himself and $20 billion for his clients by simply recognizing what should have been obvious to anybody, which was this was just insanity. But the insanity of folk who think they can vote themselves rich is the same basic thing as the insanity of folk who, for 2,500 years, a humanity for 2,500 years has avoided acknowledging what they do when it comes to their rulers. They demand that their rulers do more than what government as a limited enterprise can do. They demand that government make them rich. They demand that government take the collective resources of the community and somehow raise the standard of living for the entire community beyond simply the enforcement of law and the security of property and the prevention of foreign invasion. Government can't do that. It's not that kind of thing. And a moment's thought tells you it's not that kind of thing. The reason why the Labour Party split and the SDP was formed was precisely because the people who were clever, like Roy Jenkins and David Owen and Shirley Williams, they left because they knew what stupidity was. They could look at the Labour prospectus in 1983 and see that it was just stupid. The reason why Jeremy Corbyn was popular with stupid people was because he was stupid enough himself to say things that were completely cretinous, but say them sincerely. Because he doesn't read enough and doesn't think enough and isn't bright enough to realise how stupid they are. Corbyn is not Michael Foot, who had a romantic attachment to the post-war Labour settlement and therefore couldn't accept that, for example, the trade unions had become the enemies of the ordinary working folk. Unionised Labour had become an enemy of ordinary working folk by the mid to late 1970s. So you can understand why an elderly Michael Foot would have been, found it very, very difficult. Jim Callaghan said the same thing. Callaghan said that he just couldn't, in the winter of discontent, he just couldn't bring himself to turn his back on the trade union movement because he had too much of a sentimental attachment to it. Jeremy Corbyn doesn't have a sentimental attachment to working folk. He wasn't the man who lived through the Second World War and watched the national government in operation and watched the creation of the welfare state. This is somebody who's just been utterly and completely uninvolved in anything that didn't suit his vanity for 40 or 50 years. He would always be prepared to turn up to some meeting in outer London so that 20 people could listen to him enjoying the sound of his own voice. But he wouldn't sit down and read some basic economic primer to cause him to think that maybe there was an issue when it came to redistributing income or selling houses for low prices in central London when you could demand massive ground rents from rich people and thereby pay for other services that people need. Corbyn is a moron, a lazy, hopeless moron. That was why he appealed to so many people, because he said the things that people who don't think like to hear. It flatters them. It makes them think that without doing any reading and thinking, they've arrived at the right answer. And what could be more flattering than being told you're the kind of genius that could arrive at an answer that people who've spent decades thinking about things haven't arrived at or have arrived at a contrary answer? Jeremy Corbyn is the huckster. And as any number of people have said about the best con men don't understand that they are con men. They don't know that they're con men. Because they're not self-consciously conning you. They're telling you something they think is true. The fact that it's false and merely suits them. The people online who are selling you training courses about how to make money online don't realize that they're con men. They don't realize that they're intentionally engaged in a Ponzi scheme. because their online business is simply telling other people how to run an online business. There's no actual end product. They don't understand it. A lot of the people involved in Bitcoin are perfectly sincere. They're idiots, but they're sincere idiots. The reason why tone matters in politics is because that's all that people hear. They vote for Boris Johnson in 2019 because they like the broad music, the sound of his words, not what the words propositionally mean. So they vote for him on that basis. And they vote for other politicians like Blair in 1997 and again in 2001, 2005, again because they've got a manner. The media experts that Labour employed in 94, 97 told them very, very simple things about appearing on television. Never, ever get angry, because that is something that people will recognise. They'll see it and they'll think that you must be wrong. So always remain perfectly calm in tone. Try to get the last word as much as possible. Yeah, speak last. We know from trialing this that the person that speaks last is thought by people to have won the argument. So make sure you speak last. Wear a lilac tie. Wear a white shirt and a lilac tie if you're a male, because the lilac seems to be a very preferred colour. It's not red or blue. It's not one tribe or the other. And so on. Ronald Reagan famously got through his re-election by saying, "There you go again," every time he didn't understand what was being said, and it worked like magic. So the reason why the Labour Party, as Polly Toynbee says, needs to wear a good suit and stop, she doesn't say this, but I would suggest it, stop kneeling for Black Lives Matter, and maybe think about whether Angela Rayner and her tattoos is a good idea. But the reason why the Labour Party needs to actually look plausible is because, frankly, the appearance is all that matters. That, after all, is why Boris Johnson triumphed. Peace.